From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. My guest, director Christopher Nolan, has used both film noir and intimacy to create really personal stories with his films Memento, Following, and Insomnia. He's now using those tools to work on a movie with a much bigger set of resources and probably expectations, would be my guess. The new movie is Batman Begins. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
But it really is a noir story, Batman. I mean, obviously all of his antecedents were film noir anyway. Mm.
I think the roots of the character, when you look back at the history, the almost it's a 66-year history that this character has in comics. And, you know, he was born at the end of the 30s, very much in that cinematic period. And I think a lot of that fed into the way that Bob Kane first treated the character.
Right down to the Joker being inspired by Conrad Veidt and the Man Who Laughed.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there are a lot of – I think Bob Kane liked his movies, absolutely.
Well, if you could, tell us a little bit what the movie's about.
The movie is about the origin story of how Bruce Wayne and why Bruce Wayne becomes Batman. And that's a story that it's never been dealt with on screen. And even in the comics, strangely, there's never really been a definitive account of that origin. You have treatments of it in flashback and montage and so forth. So there are these great, what David Goyer and I would refer to as the mileposts, the sort of known bits of history. But within that, there's all kinds of freedom to explore things and flesh things out and really fill a bit of a gap in pop culture or try to. And that's what we've tried to do with this film.
Well, it's, to some extent, Frank Miller's Batman Year One, which is obviously an inspiration for you guys, does that a bit, but not to the extent that you do.
Well, Batman Year One's a huge influence on the middle portion of the film and on the tone of the whole film. And it certainly sort of pointed us in a specific direction. But at the same time, Year One sort of picks up 45 minutes into our film, if you know what I mean. There's a whole section before Miller picks up his story that hadn't been explored that seemed to me to be a very rich source of inspiration. And one of the fun things about the character, one of the great things about Batman is this sort of elemental nature, this kind of mythic quality that his story has. And I think the first third of our film, which really deals with his leaving Gotham and going around the world and finding the means to fight crime, essentially. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, the Count of Monte Cristo, things like that, this kind of part of the story where the hero is forced or has to, you know, abandon his kingdom, if you like, and discover himself and then returns changed. That's a really important part of the myth of the character, I think, but it hasn't really been addressed before.
But one of the things that you were able to use, I think, in the way that you sort of depict characters, especially protagonists, is a self-destructive loner who really has to find a way to integrate himself into a bigger world and often doesn't find the way to do that in your previous movies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I like to joke, I'd been writing a script about Howard Hughes for about a year before I came onto this project, and when Scorsese's movie got going, I decided to find another strange billionaire driven by dark impulses.
I'm thinking of the obvious noir influences on Memento and Following, where these really are characters who, against their better instincts, are driven towards these things that not only destroy their own lives, but the lives of everybody around them. And in a way, that's definitely what Bruce Wayne is about, too.
Well, I think in a great tragic story, and I think Batman ultimately, in a lot of ways, is a tragic story, the tragedy is larger if it comes from the tragic flaw within. I mean, not to get too pretentious, but from Shakespeare and all the rest, you know, it's something that has struck a chord with me. It's this idea that if the seeds of your own destruction really are internal, they really are coming from inside yourself, it heightens everything and heightens the sense of tragedy to do with everything. In the case of Batman and this story, it's a question of finding the positivity in it. It's a question of saying, here is a character, like the protagonists of my other films, I think, who is driven by extraordinarily negative things. But what makes him a heroic figure, and it's something we had to constantly bear in mind, is the fact that he's able to channel these negative impulses into something positive, into something altruistic, something relating to helping other people rather than just the notion of personal vengeance.
It's The Treatment. My guest is director Christopher Nolan. His new film is Batman Begins. I guess I'm fascinated, though, because there is and I think sort of sublimated in the movie, this sort of perverse streak of this guy who really is kind of a horrible human being who makes everybody's life worse. I mean, that's sort of hidden beneath the heroic mythos of all of it, at least it seems to me.
Don't tell anybody that before the film opens, for goodness sake. You know, it's a summer movie. There's something very, very negative about the thematic ending to the film in a sense, because there is this, without giving away too much, there is an idea that we got from the comics about escalation and about the fact that, you know, Batman's or Bruce Wayne's response to criminality is as extreme as it gets. That's going to prompt an equally extreme response ultimately. And so there is a sense of things being visited upon Gotham because of Bruce Wayne's actions. And that's something that I think is very important to the story. I mean, I find Bruce Wayne not to be unpleasant. I think he's damaged goods. I think he's a character that I wanted the audience to have a lot of sympathy for, and that's why we spend a lot of time showing what happened to him as a child and how he's arrived at where he is. There is a very hollow quality to the character that Christian's able to get across in the film, and I wanted that to haunt, you know, every frame of the film where we saw him.
He really is, in a sense, a mythic character in that because of his existence, it does beget a worse set of circumstances for the city he's essentially trying to protect.
Yes, I mean, he's a very complex, heroic figure. And I think what I wanted to do by the end of the film is leave the audience with a sense of having seen and experienced heroics and a sense of triumph, but that's oddly tempered. And that's very much sort of Gary Oldman's, you know, role at the end of the film, is to just introduce this slightly bittersweet note of things are not all wonderful and it's not simple. Batman is not a simple heroic figure, and that's the reason I was interested in him of all superheroes, because he has no superpowers. He is the most human of superheroes, therefore, and I think he's very, very flawed. And I think that the more that those flaws are allowed to just bubble under the surface, you know, underneath the sort of triumphalism, I think that makes things, I think it makes it more like real life, frankly.
I think what makes it like real life, too, is the fact that what you deal with implicitly is that there really is no circumstance that could create a Batman. And so you actually have some guy whose altruism is really kind of a mask for his obsessive quality.
Mm. It's somebody not being able to overcome their most selfish instincts. It's somebody finding a way to sublimate them or finding a way to channel them into this different persona. And there's something, you know, wonderfully healthy about that from Bruce's point of view. He finds this outlet for all his anger and his rage. But it's not necessarily as wonderful for the rest of us.
I guess what fascinates me to that end, too, is that in terms of the realism, it's the first time that in any of these movies that Gotham City seems like a real place.
Well, that was very important to me because I thought, you know, Tim Burton's vision of Batman, I thought, was extraordinarily stylized. Quite brilliant, actually, and very visionary. But extremely idiosyncratic and stylized. And what it denied me that I'd seen in the comics was the notion of Batman standing out against his environment, a relatively ordinary environment, so that the citizens of Gotham are as amazed by this iconic figure as the audience is. And that was something I was very keen to get across in this film, to try
also,
and create.
By doing that, you give us a sense of the impact then that Batman actually has on the city.
Exactly. And a sense viscerally of the impact of everything he does. If you can believe in it, if you can relate it to the textures of everyday life, then I think you're taking the audience on a more extreme journey, because things seem real and they're investing in the concrete reality of these things. I mean, certainly Gotham is an exaggeration of a modern American city, but it's exaggerated not in the textures of it, but in the larger elements of it. You know, we looked at different geographical features like the elevated freeways of Tokyo, lots of elements of New York, Chicago, bits of London, Hong Kong, you know, the walled city of Kowloon, which was this terrible slum that was demolished in Hong Kong some years ago. We've used that as the basis for our sort of worst slum area. So we were looking for these larger elements to express the exaggeration of socioeconomic elements that need to be there for the story, but have the textures always be contemporary and recognizable.
I guess, too, what fascinates me towards that end is that in that realism, the way that the battle sequences are really sort of staged like in a really messy fashion. There isn't sort of the cliche of the Hong Kong action film. We see these people get dispatched one at a time. There are crowds that have to be dealt with. And how early did that come to you as a way to stage the battles?
It came very early, because one of the things I had felt is I'd seen a lot of very skillful wire work and kung fu and all the rest creeping into American movies from Hong Kong movies, you know, over recent years. But I feel like the violence in those has now lost its threat. It's been absorbed into a comfortable mainstream environment. And I felt that, particularly in addressing Batman, you've got to have some threat. You've got to have some consequence to the violence. And so we wanted to make it more brutal, more scrappy, really throw the audience into it and disorient them a bit more. As Liam Neeson, you know, he has a line early on when he's actually fighting Bruce Wayne early on and seeing that he's learned all these kung fu skills. And he says, you know, very skilled, but this is not a dance. And then he headbutts him in a very nasty street sort of fashion and puts him down. And I wanted to have that very early on. I really try and clue people into the fact that what we're doing here is not the sort of dance like kung fu that you could happily take your grandmother to see. It's something a little more vicious than that.
Yeah, and that sort of sense of sort of viciousness, that sort of grim tone where things can't quite be sort of conquered,
yeah,
basically hangs over the entire picture.
Yeah, well, that first fight scene when, you know, Bruce is in prison, you know, in a Chinese prison, he gets attacked by the first guy. And then what I talked about with the fight coordinator, I think, is rather than having them come up, as you say, one by one and, you know, giving him every opportunity to defeat them, they all just jump on him at the same time. And it's a random brawl. And Bruce, just through sort of sheer anger and passion, is able to just throw them all off and clobber them. But it's messy and it's disorienting and you're kind of rolling around in the mud with him. And that's what we're after.
It's the treatment, I guess, of director Christopher Nolan. His new film is Batman Begins. To that end, too, and I don't mean to keep harping on this, but there is this kind of sense of that these battles are never really kind of finished and or won.
You're making it sound like a very gloomy film, Elvis.
Is that me? I'm sorry. I shouldn't have seen it beforehand.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And but there isn't a pile of dead guys at the end who've been defeated and run out of town or whatever. It's more ambiguous than that. I mean, to me, the absurdity and admirable absurdity of one man attempting to transform an entire society is fascinating to watch. But if you're telling it in realistic terms, you've got to be realistic about what's he going to achieve. For me, we spend a lot of time showing the symbolism, or the idea of the symbolism, almost political symbolism, of the bat and what the reasons are that Bruce Wayne adopts a symbolic persona rather than just, you know, fighting crime one-on-one. Because I thought the idea that in physical terms that he would think that he could literally take on all of Gotham's criminals was unrealistic and absurd. What it needed to be is that he felt by creating a symbol of the good standing against corruption, standing against the negative elements in Gotham that have brought it down, he would inspire a shift in society, that he would be the sort of the tipping point, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back and changed things for the better, really.
I guess I bring all these things up because I just wonder if you and David Goyer, as you were writing the picture and putting it together, you thought this is a kind of sort of comic book movie that people are ready for, where there are no sort of easy answers, and it's more kind of about the storytelling and one man's sort of struggle both with himself and the larger forces outside that could be a part of a more sophisticated movie using a form that people still kind of look down on.
I think that's very much the case. I believe that people are ready for a more ambiguous type of triumphalism, a more ambiguous type of heroics. And I think that Batman has always offered that. And even in his most sort of goofy incarnations in the TV series or whatever, the elemental nature of the character has always spoken through the different interpretations that he's withstood over the years, including those of the comics, because he's been interpreted and reinterpreted by a massive, you know, number of great artists and writers and all the rest. There's something fascinating and complex about Batman and ambiguous. He's darkness and light in an uneasy alliance, an uneasy balance. There's a great tension there. And I think in today's world, I think they're more readily accepting of that kind of complex heroism than something that's too simple, too straightforward, and unrealistically reassuring.
It's a treatment, I guess, is Christopher Nolan. His new movie is Batman Begins. We'll talk about some of the more playful aspects of the movie after this. More to come. It's The Treatment. Shake it, don't
break it. You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
That I'll be. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is director Christopher Nolan. His new film is Batman Begins. One of the things I really love about the movie, that it is fun, is that it clearly takes a lead from a James Bond movie. That's one of my favorites, and apparently your favorite movie of all time. And it's also a movie that inspired a Batman series in the 70s.
Mm. Well, there are a couple of the Bond films that feature a lot in this. The Spy Who Loved Me was a great favorite of mine, the best of the Roger Moore years. And I think that the 70s Batman comics drew a lot from that cinematic source from the Bond movies. And we were too, because the best of the Bond movies have created this tone, this set of internal rules, if you like, where you can have a somewhat grounded reality. You can believe in the physical reality of what's going on, the textures of it, but they can still address these fantastical elements. And another one of them that we looked at a lot was On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Which I think is the best of them, really.
It's really a fantastic movie. I saw that on the big screen sort of 10 years ago in a re-release at the National Film Theatre in London. And it's beautifully made and beautifully shot and really has wonderful production values and wonderful textures to it while still, you know, telling the story of these extraordinary heroics. And
it's also a tragic implication in that there's not been any of the Bonds before or since.
Very much. And it ends in this extraordinarily brave and tragic way that you, frankly, when you see it now, your jaw just drops at the end of that movie, that they were prepared to do what they did at the end of it.
I guess I'm reminded, too, some of the early Bond movies in that, you know, he seems more like a real character rather than somebody who has all these devices at hand that can help him defeat everything. It really comes down to his own willpower and ability and kind of insane tenacity.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's From Russia with Love, they kind of, you know, they give him a briefcase with a dagger in it. They give him some gold sovereigns hidden in the briefcase or whatever. It's all pretty down-to-earth stuff. And I think to a certain extent, Oz is the Batman equivalent of that. It's pretty out there, but we've tried to ground everything in some kind of believable military or industrial background that would, you know, allow people to invest in the reality of the gadgets he has at this stage. You don't want to take it too big at this stage, because then you lose the thread of taking the audience on that journey and seeing how all these things have come to be.
It's The Treatment, I guess, is Chris Nolan talking about Batman Begins, because it does take easily an hour to before we are introduced to what people think of the story, because I think that communicates an enormous amount of trust in the audience, which is kind of rare. That's a kind of risk-taking in these sorts of movies, isn't it?
Well, I've always had good luck so far, touch wood, in respecting the audience and believing them to be interested in similar sorts of things that I'm interested in.
And being told by people that audiences wouldn't be able to get these movies that you were making as you were making them.
Exactly. I mean, I've never listened to those comments in a way, and I've done okay, and hopefully audiences.
Does that make it tougher though for the studios? Does that make it easier then for you to say, well, I was told this before with this movie, and everybody turned with Memento, and everybody turned out to be wrong because you had that example to draw on?
Well, I think when you're making a film as big as this one, I tried not to pull out the art film, you know, Memento card too much, because that's not necessarily the kind of comparison they're looking for.
But it's a film that succeeded against an enormous amount of naysaying by people who made presumptions about the audience's intelligence and appetite.
Absolutely. And there is definitely an argument to be made on a larger scale on different terms for the same thing. But I didn't really have to make that argument much on this film, because the truth is, because the franchise had been left in what the studio considered to be, you know, a bad state, the studio was demanding a very, very fresh approach. Whereas I think ordinarily it can be hard to get a studio to acknowledge that innovation is actually what ultimately succeeds most with audiences, even though obviously there'll be plenty of failures that innovate as well. But there is a demand from audiences for innovation and freshness. In this case, because of where the franchise was and because we were reintroducing a character and that had to seem worthwhile, that was sort of a built-in argument. I didn't really have to make that case. The studio was on board with that right from the beginning. But I think, I mean, you know, the point you make about audiences is a very valid one, because when I looked at the blockbusters from my youth that I was looking back to, things from the late 70s like that first Star Wars film or Raiders of the Lost Ark, this kind of thing, or the 78 Superman that Richard Donner made that I loved, they told real stories and they took their time doing it, not in the sense that they were ever slow or boring, because they weren't, and ours is a furiously paced film, but there wasn't the same confusion that's arisen, I think, in a lot of large Hollywood films in the last 10, 20 years, the confusion between plot and premise. The idea that, you know, when you come up with a premise for a film, that shouldn't be part of the plot, that should be dispensed with within about 5 minutes, and then you chuck in another plot and you get on with that story. So there's a separation of plot and premise in a lot of Hollywood blockbusters that I don't agree with, because I think the premise should be the plot. It should be the underpinnings of it. Otherwise, you're making the sequel. And I've seen a lot of, you know, blockbusters in the last, you know, 20 years where I felt like I was watching the sequel when I was watching the first film. I think that particularly with this film, when we're trying to do something completely new, it can't play as the sequel or a sequel. You can't take the audience's knowledge or interest in a character for granted. You have to start at the beginning, draw the audience in, and frankly, do the work and build it up from the ground up.
It's kind of helped, too, that you've got an actor, a star, Christian Bale, who's capable of enormously quick shifts of emotion. Mm. And I think, for me, the perhaps the best scene that shows the real duality of the character and also the sort of playful actory side of Batman that most of us have come to love in some way is a scene where he shows up with a couple of supermodels in his Ferrari. And it's kind of all about people, him dealing with expectations and also sort of kind of the upstage look at who Batman really is that nobody else gets to see. And that must have been an enormously rewarding scene for Bale to play.
I think he had fun playing it, and I think that shows. And I think that, as Alfred's character says, you know, if you start pretending to have a little fun, you might have a little by accident. I think that almost applied to the actor in a sense. It's like he got an opportunity in that scene to really play around with it and play up a bit. And I think he does a beautiful job of it, because what he's able to do, and I've been fortunate to work with some fine actors in the past, and what they all share is an ability to project a couple of levels at the same time, just through their eyes, through their movements, the way they're speaking. You're watching Bruce Wayne as a sort of playboy brat, but at the same time, you're always kind of aware of the fact that he's thinking other things behind it. And then there are nice moments where he almost enjoys a little bit too much. There's a scene that I very much like, what Christian did in it, where he has to get rid of the guests at a party, and he does so by pretending to be drunk and venting this spleen, you know, against the hangers-on and the people sort of sucking up to Bruce Wayne's wealth. And what I love about the way he plays that is you can tell there's a little bit of truth to it. It's an act, but at the same time, he is actually venting a little bit of bitterness there, you know, Bruce Wayne's actual sort of bitterness against these people. And that's what makes it interesting to me, is these different things going on at the same time.
And that's funny, because I feel that happens with a number of characters. With Alfred is played by Michael Caine, with Lucius Fox is sort of played by Morgan Freeman. There seems to be two things going on with the characters almost at all times.
Well, yeah, when you're taking on a story of duality, it seemed to me that you're going to have similar things going on with a lot of the characters around him. Well, certainly you want layers to those characters, because what makes Bruce Wayne interesting is that he is a complex person, and if everybody around him isn't similarly complex, then he's not going to sort of fit in with the tone of the film. The film had to have a naturalistic tone. And to me, human beings are very complex. And I think you feel the complexity of human beings in the simplest conversations. And that's what great actors like Michael Caine, Morgan Freeman, Liam Neeson, Gary Oldman, these guys are all capable of doing this.
It's the treatment. We're talking to Chris Nolan about Batman Begins, his new movie. Even given the scale of this, it's still an incredibly intimate story, which is something has, for the most part, been lacking from the other movies. Even though there are a lot more people in it than there have been in the other movies, it feels more like an ensemble than the other movies have. It really is a story kind of on a very sort of intense, minute emotional scale, isn't it?
That's what I've tried to do, certainly. It is for me. And what that comes from for me is trying to tell the story as much as possible, as far as possible, from Bruce Wayne's point of view. That, to me, seemed like
an interesting...
Do you think
that had been missing from other movies?
Well, I don't think anyone had ever really tried to do that before. My fascination with storytelling in films is all about that subjectivity. It's all about whose point of view am I seeing the story from.
Which also allows you an interesting way to cheat, because if it's from his point of view, there's information that he doesn't get, which you can also keep from the audience, too.
Exactly. I mean, those kind of games, particularly in film noir, and a lot of this film, you know, comes from those influences. As you pointed out, that's very much the game. It's creating a maze and then putting the audience into the maze with the rat, if you like, rather than hanging above it and seeing him make the wrong turns. You kind of make those mistakes with the character.
But you're dealing with the genre. We're talking about comic book movies that are kind of about an omniscience, you know, an audience being able to have all the information, because essentially the lead character always does. What you were doing with this, to a great extent, is negating all those, or a lot of those conventions, or just sort of pushing them aside. Was that really conscious for you? Is that just happened to be a byproduct of the way you tell stories?
It's a product of me approaching this film the way I have any other film. and not worrying about whether that's appropriate or not. I think in the comics, as far as Batman goes, there have been some great stories where they do adopt a more subjective approach, particularly in the stories with Ra's al Ghul, actually, where he's always orchestrating things around Batman, and you're discovering this with Batman, who is this detective figure. And that was something we certainly looked at. But also, I think a lot of the idea of the omniscience and all the rest, it's more to do with the cinematic genre than the comics. It's more to do with, you know, in these action movies, having to always tell multiple parallel stories and lay everything out for the audience and all the rest. I think for me, there's something a little disappointing in that because you're not getting to discover things with the character. There are moments in this film where we step outside Batman's point of view, and we have to get the story told. That's certainly the case. But as a guiding principle, I always wanted to try and align the audience with Bruce Wayne's perception. I felt that if we could give people really the thrill of kind of jumping off a building with Batman and opening his cape and gliding with him, if we could really sort of make them invest in that reality and take them on that ride, that would be a lot more fun.
You must have liked this material too, going to Ra's al Ghul, as played by Ken Watanabe here, because that really is the only Batman villain who's actually like a Bond villain.
Yeah, he's very much drawn from the Bond villains. There's a lot of Hugo Drax in him and that kind of thing. And that to me felt a very useful approach because we were looking to ground everything in reality. A lot of the more exotic Batman villains, or more obviously what they refer to as the transformative villains, who drew a lot from the Dick Tracy comic strips at the time, that's a very hard thing to place into the terms of storytelling that we've set up in this film. Whereas Ra's al Ghul, who is a great Batman villain from the 70s comics, he actually fits pretty nicely into that Bond villain mold. And the best of the Bond villains were very colorful and very interesting in their own right, but they never overshadowed Bond. And that was the key to what we're trying to do here. We never wanted to create an interesting villain at the expense of Batman.
Especially in the comics, he constantly refers to Batman as detective, which is both kind of an assessment of Batman is, but also a diminution of Batman as compared to the power of Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, very much. We tried, I think, through this idea of subjectivity and through the idea of having a very noirish, complex thriller plot in the middle of the film with various reveals of the sort of hierarchy of villainy, if you like, and Batman discovering these things as he goes, we tried to get across the detective aspect of Batman that I hadn't really seen done before other than in a hardware sense, other than him being at the computer in the Batcave or whatever and figuring something out. But I'd never really seen him kind of case the joint, if you will, and go in and discover something and interrogate somebody and this kind of thing. We wanted to get those beats in because I felt that was an interesting aspect to his character that had been lost from the comic books.
Well, I think it really is an extraordinary movie, and I'm glad you're able to stop by to talk about it.
Well, thank you very much.
My guest is Christopher Nolan. His new movie, which is a lot of fun in addition to being, well, about some darker elements, is Batman Begins. Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with technical assistance from Wojciech Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge is the producer. I'm not the Dark Knight detective. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.